Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Welcome, July 21st, Monday. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from our studios on the banks of the Willamette River here in Portland, Oregon. Back home from Lansing, from Michigan over the weekend, where we stayed with my brother Steve and his partner Tammy, and they had two quick stories, and then we'll get into our show here. They had this kitten, this wild kitten. They have got a bunch of cats in their house. Tammy works in a vet's office. And they had this one kitten that they were trying to get into the adoption program, but it was too misbehaved. It constantly attacked everybody. Just, you know, it just was an attack cat. And so they had it because, you know, they couldn't put it in the adoption program because it was too misbehaved. And they're 12 weeks old. And so Louise, of course, fell in love with this cat. It's a little Higgins kitty. So we brought it home. So we've got a new addition to our house. And if you have suggestions for the name of this cat, we're going to give away a copy of Screwed, my book Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Signed copy for free to whomever comes up with the name with this. Our Name the Cat or Kitten contest today. We'll be taking entries over at our blog for today's show blog over at TomHartman.com. So post them over there, and we'll let you know at the end of the day. And also, we went shooting over the weekend. My brother Steve and Tammy and I. Tammy's got a whole bunch of handguns, and Steve's got a couple. And so we went down to the range. And I just have to tell you one really interesting story about this. First of all, my NRA membership card got me a couple of free targets, and so I'm looking at the targets that they've got. And they used to have a wall full. I mean, they got this whole wall full of targets, right? Of shooting targets, paper targets, plastic targets, all kinds of targets. You can go and take it into the range. And the last time I was there, and I get there about every year, and the three of us go down and, you know, take a couple hours and just, you know, blow off a couple hundred rounds. And the last couple of times I've there, they've had these Osama bin Laden targets and kind of, you know, guys in turbans targets and all these kind of things. This time, and this is the largest shooting range in the Lansing area, as far as I know. It's actually in Mason. And Lansing's the state capital. This time, there was not a single Osama bin Laden target. They were all, in fact, the one target that I shot at for a while was a deck of cards. So you could, like, you know, try to get the four aces and then try to get the four kings and like that, you know, on a large sheet. Or just regular traditional targets. But no more Osama. I think as a country, we're getting over the hysteria. I really do. I think that was a really significant sign for me. So anyhow, Carrie Lucas is with us. Carrie, the Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. Hey, Carrie, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
It's always a pleasure having you on. I want to talk today about whether or not education, particularly higher education, college education, should be a right of privilege in the United States. We pretty much decided that, you know, secondary education, that elementary school and high school, junior high school, should be a right. We for all practical purposes, mandate it. But and Barack Obama is suggesting, you know, this $4,000 tax credit per student in exchange for 100 hours work. Actually, he's proposed the tax credit, and he's also proposed just $4,000 here in exchange for 100 hours work. John McCain is saying that we should make savings accounts tax-free for parents who want to save money for their children's education. What say you?
You know, I think we need need to be real careful first in using the language of rights. You know, when we first started talking about when America was, you know, creating the Bill of Rights and things like that, it was really, we recognized that rights are something that we have in ourselves. And this whole idea of I have a right to something that you have to provide to me, I think is a dangerous slope to go down. So I'm all for the idea that we need to make sure that everybody has access to an education. But particularly when we're talking to something about higher education, I think that's that the language of rights is kind of dangerous.
So you think we should make our public school system voluntary?
You know, I think when it comes to, we've made a decision as a country that for K through 12 education, we need to make sure that everybody has the basics to be able to participate in society. I think what we should really, you know, when I think about education policy and what you know, Senator Obama and Senator McCain should be thinking about, I would think that getting our K through 12 system is really what's important. One of the things that's a real shame what's gone on in our higher education is it's really now taking over what, some of what we thought high schools would do.
Well, but Carrie, that's the point, is that in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, when the K through 12 system was really built, I mean, you know, it at the turn of the century, 1900, Teddy Roosevelt's time, public school was voluntary by and large. I mean, the whole trend toward mandatory, compulsory public education paid for by taxpayers started in the 1880s, you know, Horace Mann, and started in Boston, actually, to try to break the back of the Catholic movement, you know, which is a whole another story. It's a fascinating story where actually public education, in my mind, was the bad guy in that story. But nonetheless, from the 30s until the 80s, arguably, or the 90s, if you got a high school education, you could get a good job in America. So what we said was, we want everybody to be employable. To be employable, you have to have a high school education. Now, because of this, because we've offshored all the manufacturing jobs, the blue-collar and pink-collar jobs are going and gone. We're basically left with white-collar jobs. And there seems to be a consensus, even among Republicans, if you want to get a decent job today, you know, you've got to get a college education. Shouldn't we then say that it used to be that you could get, you know, with a high school diploma, you could get a decent job, and so we made sure that you got a high school diploma. Now you've got to get a college education to get a decent job, so we're going to be able to make, we're going to help make sure that you can get a college education the way that China and India are doing it.
Well, yeah, I think that one of the problems is that now it's not only that now we need, you need to be smarter and have more skills to get a job. I think it's also that high school diplomas don't mean very much anymore.
That's my point.
But one solution, instead of trying to push more and more public resources towards getting us into college, because we, you know, and I think, of course, I think that people should try to get college degrees, but before we decide as a nation to start just pushing tons of public resources towards increasing the amount of higher education that we consume, we should figure out what are we really getting from higher education? Because a lot of what higher education, what goes on in higher education, is completely useless.
Well, but what Denmark found was that for every dollar they invested in higher education, over the lifetime of that person, they got somewhere between $10 and $100 back in taxes.
Okay, well,
so it's an investment.
I think that I went to, you know, I've got a master's degree, and I made a huge investment, took out a lot of loans to do that. But the person who, and yes, I pay more taxes now probably as a result of that investment. So there's been some.
Right. So it should have been a cultural investment rather than your investment.
Sure. But I'm the person who made that decision and who decided that that made sense for me. And I enjoy most of the benefits of that. I think that there's a lot of things that have some effect on the public at large, but we shouldn't take away the idea that this is really at the end of the day, only individuals can decide. I also think that one of the problems with making this entirely making it, you know, a public or a public good is that then you really will have much less quality control. When I made the decision whether to go back to college or to graduate school, I was thinking, okay, what is this going to buy me? Because it was expensive. It was a big decision where, you know, I think a lot of times right now people are going onto college and not demanding much for that enormous investment.
So are you opposed to the McCain plan of private saving, of using taxpayer dollars, or of discounting, you know, so that we no longer pay taxes? In other words, giving a government subsidy to parents who are saving money for their children's education.
No, I think that in particular, because when we talk about saving for education, that doesn't have to be this bias towards four-year institutions or two-year institutions. We need to also think about, you know, I think
trade schools and things.
For, hope for a day when instead of saying everybody's going to go off, grab their backpacks, and spend 4 years in a dorm and spend all this money on a bunch of wasteful stuff, and instead think, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to spend $2,000 on a laptop and some online learning courses and really learn skills that are going to stay with me. You know, you think about, I'm talking about the investment I made in grad school. I think it was a terrible decision. I didn't get my money's worth at all for going to grad school. And in part because I was paying for all this nonsense that went along with a huge university, and very little was being done that was...
You mean stuff like sociology and geography and...
No, just
English lit.
You know, huge cafeterias and big events and all of the trappings of university life that really don't do anything to further us as in our education. I think there's a lot of people out there who are frustrated. You know, when you think about parents looking at paying for college, so much of it, very little of it goes into our classrooms. That's one of the problems we need to think about.
Well, I don't disagree with you. In Berea College, for example, Berea, I don't know if you saw the thing in the New York Times about it, but you might want to check it out. It's absolutely free, always, for everybody. And the furniture is made by the College Crafts Workshops. They grow their own food, and every student has to work 10 hours on the campus. Carrie Lucas, IWF.com. Thanks, .org. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks so much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour, especially education. I'll tell you. And this is the basis of a strong middle class. In 1813, Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to John Adams in which he talked about the need to undermine what he referred to as the pseudo-aristocracy. These are two ex-presidents. Now, the 1813, that would have been, James Monroe's presidency, as I recall. In any case, they put together a bill for the more general diffusion of learning, it was called, that would provide for free college education, all the way up to college, for anyone in the United States who could do it. It was rejected. It has never been passed ever since then. Thomas Jefferson tried, John Adams tried, political enemies tried. And he just thought it would be good for citizenship. And, you know, as in Paris, when he was the U.S. minister to France, he wrote a letter in which he said, I am appalled by the ignorance, poverty, and oppression of the masses of the people. Why? They didn't have free education. So what did he do? The three things that are listed on his tombstone, none of them is that he was president of the United States. One of them is that he's the founder of the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia was a free college, the first free college in the United States. And that was how he accomplished, you know, his vision. And anyway, I really think that we need to do that, because then we might have people who are smart enough to know that when John McCain and all of his surrogates, we were driving around in Michigan on Saturday, and of course all you can get is right-wing talk radio, so I was listening to Sean Hannity, or a repeat of his Friday show, and he had a guest on going, oh yeah, you know, there wasn't a drop of oil spilled during Katrina or Rita. That proves that we can have offshore rigs and they're totally safe. And of course, John McCain had been saying the same thing. You know,
as for offshore drilling, it's safe enough these days that not even Hurricanes Katrina and Rita could cause significant spillage from the battered rigs off the coasts of New Orleans and Houston.
And that has been repeated over and over and over again, and it's a lie. It's just a very, very simple lie. Hurricane Katrina and Rita caused over 124 offshore spills for a total of 743,700 gallons offshore. Now, just for reference, anything over 100,000 gallons is considered a major spill, and there were over 700,000 gallons, 554,000 gallons of crude oil and condensate from platforms, rigs, and pipelines, and 189,000 gallons of refined products. Much of that was close to shore or onshore or in ships. Six major spills of 42,000 gallons or greater, the largest of these, the largest single spill as a result of the hurricanes, offshore was 152,250 gallons. This is one of the six major spills offshore out of the total 124 spills. So, I mean, this was worse than the Exxon Valdez. And yet the Republicans are still lying about it. Hannity is still lying about it. All these guys are still lying about it. Why? Because ExxonMobil and their very small handful of corporate buddies want to lock up as much public land as possible. Louise, by the way, wants me to tell you we are not going to necessarily name the cat today. We will be taking entries until we get a name that she says, yeah, that's the name. So it may take a couple of days, but you can post your entry for it's a gray tiger, a gray silver tiger. And this little kitten's like 12 weeks old, and you walk into the room, and he'll run across the room and land on your leg, and you know, with his claws and his teeth. And so he loves to bite. He's not all that well behaved. And I just want to mention again, I think you know, going shooting this weekend with Steve, with my brother and his partner Tammy, that. And not seeing any Obama targets. The other thing that I kind of like to, you know, I love hanging out in the shooting range, and one of them is that, you know, they also sell hunting rifles, and you see the guys coming in for the hunting rifles, and these are people who are buying weapons to kill things, which to me is just like totally weird. It's so completely alien. Steve and Tam live out in the woods. And they've got a bunch of turkeys out there, and they've got deer, and they feed them, and they've got a place for ferret. They actually have an outdoor little cat nest for feral cats, you know, that they take care of. And, you know, and they own a bunch of guns. But I don't think any of us would ever think, and we grew up in Michigan. You know, all of our friends went hunting. I went fishing a couple times when I was a kid. It grossed me out. The whole idea of let's go out and kill something that's alive and call that sport is, I think, frankly, pathetic. It reflects a mindset, a mentality that I can't understand. I target shooting is fun. It's a game. I mean, you know, it's toys for boys. And I understand owning weapons for protection. And, you know, I vaguely understand the notion of owning weapons in case George Bush declares martial law or something, God forbid. But, you know, going out and saying, I'm going to go kill things. I remember when I was in college, we had this, there was a cat, a feral cat that was attacking people. And a bunch of people in our house, one of the guys in our house decided he was going to shoot this cat because it kept attacking people as it tried to get into the house. And we were standing out in the backyard, and he had a .22 pistol. And it took five or six shots to kill that cat. And that cat was flying all over the place and blood flying all over the place. It was the most god-awful, tragic, disgusting thing. I just can't imagine why people would want to go out in the woods and kill things for fun. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I don't want to totally trash all hunters or fishers. Or women. I get it that some people do that and they think it's fun. And Tom Brown Jr. wrote The Tracker and a whole bunch of books like this and has a great perspective on this. Kirk Caltrider, a friend of mine, wrote a couple of books on Native American history. And people who must hunt for food typically have tremendous respect for the food they're hunting. I mean, they pray for it before they go out. They thank it as it's dying. They honor it as they're eating it. It's a completely different thing than let's go kill something for fun. And that's my point. And I realize that there are some hunters out there, and particularly some people who, you know, one deer a year is half their food supply for the year because, you know, that's their income. I mean, I lived along a road full of people like that when we lived in rural Vermont, people who literally hunted for, you know, half their meat supply for the year. And I honor that. But I also know people who's like, hey, let's go out and shoot something. I'm sorry. It just, you know. But I thought it was fascinating. No more Osama bin Laden targets in the range. Very strange. Or very interesting. Speaking of strange, though, our...
that old Beach Boys song, Bomberan. Bom, bom, bom. Anyway.
Our John McCain Iran alert for the day. Yeah, it's Bomberan. Now, if you look at a map, you could just kind of, you know, Iraq is sort of like California. I mean, just think of the U.S. as the Middle East, right? Iraq is California. Saudi Arabia south of Iraq would be like maybe Mexico. And then all the states in the middle, this huge landmass from California to, say, the, to the Appalachians. That's Iran. The stuff in the middle is Iran. And then Afghanistan would be like Massachusetts. North of it is Turkmenistan. That would be like New England. And south of it is Pakistan. That would be like South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. Okay, so Pakistan is way over on the East Coast. Iraq is way over on the West Coast. And in the middle is Iran. Apparently, a fact... So, in other words, Iraq has no border with Pakistan. Iraq is 1,000 miles away from Pakistan, just like the border of California is 1,000 miles away from the border with Massachusetts or more. But apparently John McCain doesn't know that.
Do you agree the situation in Afghanistan is precarious and urgent?
Well, I think it's very serious.
Not precarious,
it's a serious situation. Oh, I don't know exactly whether run through the vocabulary, but it's a serious situation, but there's a lot of things we need to do. We have a lot of work to do, and I'm afraid that it's a very hard struggle, particularly given the situation on the Iraq-Pakistan border. And I would not announce that I'm going to attack Pakistan, as Senator Obama did when he was during his campaign.
The Iraq-Pakistan border. Yeah, Pakistan and Afghanistan share a border, as I said. You know, you think of Afghanistan as Massachusetts and the New England states in aggregate, arguably in Pakistan as the southeastern states in aggregate, and then, you know, of course you get down to the Gulf. Sorry, John, got it all wrong. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. I caught the tail end of what you were saying about hunters and those who just hunt for sport. I would extend that to fishermen.
Yeah, that was I said that in my original rant.
As a kid, I never
went hunting, but I did go fishing two or three times, and it always just totally grossed me out. It's like, you know.
Oh, I had just tuned you in, and that's why I'm a vegetarian.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe my worldview has been informed by that, because from the time I was 16 until about 4 years ago, I was an absolute total vegetarian. For about a third of that, I was a vegan. And the last couple of years, we occasionally eat fish, so I guess I can't complain about fish. You know, living here in the Pacific Northwest, you get a salad with some salmon on it or something. But point taken, and don't disagree. Tom in Indianapolis. Hey, Tom.
Good morning, Tom. I was wondering if you caught the 60 Minutes yesterday about Darfur.
I did. We actually played while we were flying home, but we recorded it, and I watched it, and I thought it was excellent. And kudos to Scott Pelley for taking essentially the same trip that we took when we did our show live from that region in March. Although he went into Darfur, we were only on the border, and he went during the rainy season, which is frankly a lot more difficult and more dangerous. We went during the dry season; it's a little easier to get around. But that was a marvelous report. If you haven't seen it, if it replays, watch it. But what he did was he documented the genocide, the ongoing genocide of the citizens of Darfur, which is part of Sudan. Darfur is to Sudan like California is to the United States. It's this giant region on the western coast of Sudan. And Bashir has now been indicted by the World Court as a, you know, the same way that, that the Nazis were, for crimes against humanity, as a criminal for genocide. And Scott Pelley went over there with 60 Minutes and documented the thing. And it was
brilliant. I thought it was a great piece.
Yeah.
I really did. I think that it's kind of ironic with the Olympics coming on. I think that we could really say it, give a statement if we would at least boycott the opening ceremony.
Yeah, and the reason why, and that's the one thing that they didn't talk about in the 60 Minutes piece, or if they did, it was so small that I don't remember it, and thanks for the call, Tom, was the fact that China is providing the weapons to Sudan. We're providing a lot of money to Sudan, by the way, because Osama bin Laden lived there for 5 years, and so they've been giving us intelligence. In exchange for that, we've been turning a blind eye to genocide. But China is pumping oil out of Sudan like there's no tomorrow. And they are providing weapons to the North, which are being used for this genocide. And they are not being subject to the kind of international pressure for this that they should be, in my opinion. Tom in Ocean City, New Jersey. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hi. You were talking earlier about education and should education be a right?
Yes.
Or,
higher education, should it be a right or a privilege? All education, for that matter, yeah.
Well, I think it should be a right, and I think the notion of the tax breaks for people who can save for education is a wonderful idea for the wealthy who can afford to save.
Well, that's why John McCain is proposing
health care.
John McCain is worth $100 million is proposing that if you set some money aside,
save up for groceries.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, this is crazy. And for those families who can't save up for groceries, or for those who are just getting by and they can pay for the groceries, but they can't put, you know, $30,000-$40,000 in the bank to pay for their kid to go to even a modest college, for them, I mean, the investment in educating their child so that she or he can become a really significantly productive member of society is huge. Everybody's running around going, oh, America, you know, we're falling behind. Well, you know, in other countries, education is free. In virtually all of the European and Scandinavian countries, higher education is absolutely free. And we need to be doing the same thing here in the United States. This is just nuts. April in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, April, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. I'm calling about naming your new cat.
Oh, well, we're taking entries actually on the blog. So to officially put a name in, you have to go over to TomHartmann.com. And in fact, we have 21 names suggested so far. Louise's favorite so far is Magnum PI. But what's your suggestion, April?
Oh, I don't have a computer, so if you could take my suggestion.
Sure.
I think you should call him Ivan, as in Ivan the Terrible.
Well, that's a good one. You know, Ivan, you know, or Vlad the Impaler. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Let's see here. Herb. Is it Herb in Massachusetts?
That's right. It's me.
Yeah.
First of all, I'll say that I voted for Bush twice, and I'll probably regret it for the rest of my life. Okay? There's my first statement.
Okay.
Secondly, I listen to you because I can't stand listening to his apologist, Fat Boy Limbaugh, anymore.
Yeah.
But more importantly,
well, and apparently you're not alone in that. We're on the air. We've been on the air live noon to 3 Eastern time for 6 years now, and now in 2 different major markets. So we've beat Limbaugh in the ratings.
But I will also say you can't go giving McCain crap on his map, okay, as you just did a few minutes ago, when your boy Barack Obama thinks we have 57 states.
Oh, really?
Well, he said it in one of his speeches. He just said it recently in one of his speeches.
57
states. 57 states.
Are you sure he wasn't talking about the various territories that have,
no,
you know?
No, he was speaking about traveling around the United States and made a statement that I've been to 57 states.
So you can bust
our boy. McCain's been through hell. Barack has put in 1 year of work and then took yours and mine.
I'll tell you what, Herb. I'll acknowledge that in all probability McCain meant Afghanistan, Pakistan, in all probability, because the question was about Afghanistan.
Right.
And if you'll acknowledge that in all probability what Barack Obama was talking about was they went to Puerto Rico, they went to the Virgin Islands, or I'm not sure if they went to the Virgin Islands, but I mean, there's a bunch of U.S. territories where people could vote in the primaries. And if he made a statement like that, my guess, and which I don't know, my guess would be it would have been in that context. But you're not going to cut me that slack, huh?
No, I'm not going to cut you that slack.
All righty. Well, you know, good try. What can I say? It's, you know, I think, and frankly, I don't know what Barack Obama said. But, you know, the guy's was a constitutional scholar. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's constitutional law. He knows there's 50 states. Just like, in all probability, John McCain knows that there's a border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, you know, perhaps it was a cheap shot to say, you know, it was a joke. But on the other hand, I don't think this is a cheap shot at all.
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan.
I think that's dangerous.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes before the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Lorraine in Lakewood. Is that Lakewood, Florida?
Hello?
Hey, what state Lakewood's in?
Lakewood is in Florida.
In Florida. Okay, I thought so. Hey, Lorraine, what's up?
I've been listening to your broadcast about the questions on whether or not education should be a right or a privilege, actually.
Mm-hmm.
To my mind, it should be a matter, a priority, because of national security. In a world where you have education as a right and as a, not an optional thing, is it people in Russia and other countries, it's very dangerous for the United States to be that far back
yeah.
in its educational graduates in whatever, be they college or trade schools or however it wants to be defined, it's very, very dangerous for us to be so backward.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Lorraine, and very well said. Thank you for calling and making the point. Max in St. Louis. Hey,
well,
Max.
Good morning. First of all, I want to talk about Nouri al-Maliki, Prime Minister of Iraq, Nouri al-Maliki's latest discussion of timetables, but this has to do with Senator McCain and his repeating the misinformation on no oil spills during Katrina and Rita.
Right.
Where is the media calling him out on that? I mean, it's one thing.
It ain't happening. It ain't happening. They're
no,
allowing.
Not happening. But this past weekend, I will tell you on both the Sunday evening national CBS and NBC News, there were stories done on the press stories on the two senators, showing how Obama's getting more ink, shall we say, than McCain. And we both, and I think we all, and Obama's getting criticized now for going over there. He was being called out for not
right.
going
Right, McCain used to have a clock on his website that
yeah.
says how many days since Obama's been to Iraq. McCain called for this. McCain, by the way, when he went over there in March, had an opportunity to have a whole lot more press coverage. He actually put a clamp on it. He scaled it down. But Max, I think your original point about Maliki's saying that he thinks that the 16-month timetable that Barack Obama has suggested is a good one. He had this was an interview with Der Spiegel, the German newspaper. Der Spiegel is standing by that. Newsweek translated it from the German to English. They're standing by that. Everybody's standing by that. But see, right after Maliki said that to Spiegel and Spiegel played it, Der Spiegel published it, the phone rang. It was the U.S. Embassy calling Mr. Maliki, Mr. Nouri al-Maliki, the Prime Minister of Iraq, saying, ahem, you will not say nice things about Barack Obama. And all of a sudden now he's saying, I guess I didn't really say that. You know, I didn't. Anna in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Anna, what's on your mind today? Hey, Anna.
Oh, hi. I'm so sorry.
Is that all right?
I had a question about the Fannie Mae cut situation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been listening all morning, even earlier to you and Carl Wolfson, and you mentioned at one point about the bailout. Everyone knows about that. I haven't heard the exact amount yet. But like two sentences later, you mentioned that the government still owns stock in Fannie Mae, which they're considering selling to the tune of $30
billion. Right.
My thought was, why don't they just save the difference and bail out Fannie Mae as much as they can, but hang on to their money?
Yeah, I think, frankly, I think that what should happen is that Fannie Mae should be and Freddie Mac should be taken private and made back into the government agencies that they started out as. I think it's just absolutely crazy that we have these hybrid institutions. This is the result of this privatization mania that started with Reagan, and these were governmental institutions for a reason. And they need to go back to being governmental institutions for a reason rather than government-protected private for-profit corporations that are not operating for the reason of helping the housing market, but are operating for the reason of showing a profit for their stockholders, which is the wrong way to do it. Ryan in Grand Rapids, you wanted to challenge me on fishing?
Didn't I hear you say something about fishing, how fishing's cruel to fish?
I just said it grosses me out. I don't think that fish have the same kind of emotions that dogs, cats, deer, you know, mammals do. I have a hard time killing mammals for fun, and birds for that matter. I mean, we live in the river here in a house in the river, and you know, that floats in the river. And I got geese and duck on my back porch. Every year they have babies. They're super protective of them. They follow them around. We got some fish that our next door neighbor actually feeds cat food to.
It's okay to build a house on a river and destroy their habitat, but it's not to fish them.
Well, we're actually floating on the river, so we're not destroying their habitat. I live on a house that's floating on some pontoons that's attached to a dock, and the most damage that we've done to the river is to drive some pilings, you know, 12-inch pipes down into the river bed that hold the dock in place. So that's it. I'm sorry. I'm not apologizing for that. Kim in San Francisco. Hey, Kim.
Hi, Tom. Hey, listen, talking about educating everyone, of course. I can't think of too many people that don't want that. But here's my question.
Every Republican doesn't want that. They're talking about they want to privatize our public school system with vouchers, and they definitely don't want anybody to pay for. They don't want we the people paying for higher education.
Okay, sorry, I wasn't even including the Republicans.
Okay.
Anyway, but the real question that I have is exactly how many jobs do we have out there? And this is my point, is we have had a major revolution in this country over the last 30 years. I don't know if the young people really understand that 30 years ago, most people did not have a personal computer in their house. Mm-hmm. When you add together the technological advances that we've had in this society, along with immigration and globalism and outsourcing and everything else, you have got an American workforce basically on their knees. So many changes in labor laws. There's been so many changes in just basically the workforce of this country are there enough jobs out there?
Yeah, and we need to be educating people. Kim, thank you for the call. It's the top of the hour. We got to wrap this hour up. In the next hour, Bill and Janet Cohen. Bill Cohen, the former defense secretary, the Republican. He's a Republican. She's a Democrat. And even more than that, they'll be with us. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Bill Cohen, the Republican that Bill Clinton appointed as Secretary of Defense, was the best man at John McCain's second wedding. His wife, Janet, and Bill is white, is European ancestry. His wife, Janet, is African-American and has endorsed a candidate. She's a Democrat. Bill's a Republican, still is. And they're married, obviously. and have this extraordinary new book out, Love in Black and White, a memoir of race, religion, and romance. And they're going to be also speaking at a forum at the D.C. Press Club on the 24th. But Bill Cohen and Janet Cohen, welcome to both of you to our program.
Tom, it's great to be with you.
Hi,
Thank
Tom.
You. Hi, Janet. Thank you so much for joining us. Race in America is a topic that people speak of in sound bites, but they tend not to discuss, at least on outside of, you know, my friend Joe Madison does a show that's in the, quote, black radio realm, I guess, you know, over on XM and on the urban station, the urban radio station in Washington, D.C., and, you know, talks about race a lot. But you don't hear much talk about it in, quote, mainstream or corporate America or whatever. Janet, what's your take on how race is playing out in this election?
Well, before we get to that, I want to say that we want to thank you for having us on to talk about this subject. Joe Madison is a great friend of ours, and while his show is African-American, race-specific many times, I understand from my white friends that white America talks about race, too, among themselves, and not always in the most glowing terms.
You're right.
It seems that we have great difficulty, we Americans, black and white, or I should say white and non-white, of discussing the subject of race and racism and our history and how we got here and what we're going to do about it across the racial divide. And that's what we want, Bill and I want, as the mission to be on this race and reconciliation in America that we're having at the National Press Club on the 24th and 25th. We want everyone to come. Leave your blame. Leave your shame. Leave your guilt, your denial. Just bring your feelings and your ideas and suggestions on how we cross this racial divide. I think it's in America's interest to do that.
Janet, thanks for your kind words about Joe. I mean, Joe is just such a great guy. We went to Darfur together in March to southern Sudan, and he's been there now six times, I think. I mean, Joe is out there saving lives. I mean, it's just Joe Madison is one of my heroes, and I'm so honored to call him a friend. And he does great radio, by the way, which goes, as you said, beyond just race. In any case, I have had conservatives on this program. We regularly have conservatives on the show. And I'd like to get your take on, and then I'd like to get Bill's take on this as well, who say, oh, you know, this whole problem of race in America is overblown. And, you know, it's just people wanting quotas, in quotes, in other words, affirmative action, and et cetera, et cetera. And yet I hear stories from African Americans that they still can't flag a cab in Manhattan. In fact, I witnessed this happen just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. I was in Manhattan, and maybe it was a little longer than that. And there was a couple of black men and a white woman who were about 20 feet up from us, and they were trying to flag a cab, and Ron Hartenbaum and I were trying to flag a cab. And the first cab came up to us first. We were the first in line, as it were. And I said, and there was another cab behind them. They were both hot, you know. And so I said to the cab that pulled up to me, why don't you go up to that couple and take them, and we'll take the next cab.
Mm-hmm.
And he took one look at them and then just drove off, wouldn't pick them up.
Mm.
And we watched three cabs miss these people. I mean, you know, we tried this three times. And it was the third try that somebody said, okay, I'll go pick them up. I mean, is racism still – is that still the experience of African Americans, or was that just
absolutely
a weird day for me?
I should say absolutely, and I'll let Bill speak since my allergies are preventing me. And Bill, you'll be happy to hear I can't talk today. But no, that is the story of our lives. And for those who say racism is over or race is not an issue, haven't had any issues with racism.
Yeah, apparently. Bill Cohen, you're a Republican. You're the former Secretary of Defense in a Democratic administration, the Clinton administration, a white guy married to an African-American woman. What have you learned about race that, I mean, did you grow up? I mean, I grew up with relatively little contact with African-Americans until I was in my teens. And I'm wondering what your experience was growing up and how your perspective has changed as a result of being married to Janet.
Well, you know, I grew up in Bangor, Maine, and to say the least, there was not a very large black population in Bangor. And it was not officially segregated, but the small number of black families who lived in Bangor were located in one area. And the attitude was, on the part of virtually everyone in the community, the blacks are fine, they're welcome, and they were called Negroes at that time. They're welcome in our city, provided they stay in their place.
Yep.
And that place was on the other side of where most of the folks were living on the east side. They were on the west side, and they had a specific location. And that was the attitude. I think my I was influenced by the fact that I came into contact at a relatively early age with Dow Air Force Base located. It was a SAC base, a Strategic Air Command, with a very significant black population. And I used to go up to Dow Air Force Base and play basketball. And I was allowed to play with the black basketball players. And so I learned pretty early on that they were just people like we were people. And I also come from a background of some split heritage. My mother was Irish and my father was Jewish. And as a result of that, I was not really accepted by either community and sort of was on the outside of things, at least from a social perspective. And so it gave me a different insight into the world of discrimination, the world of bigotry. Anti-Semitism was still pretty high in Bangor, Maine at that time.
Yeah.
And so I would find my car when I was in high school having the tires cut and other things. And so it gave me a sensitivity perhaps that I might not otherwise have had.
Yeah, it seems to me sometimes that the Lou Dobbs and Pat Buchanans of the world, not to pick on them specifically, but I think that they are emblematic of a particular perspective among, by and large, some white Americans.
What percentage, Tom, do you think that they represent America, white America?
You know, Janet, I think it's regional. I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, you know, a very blue-collar area. We lived in Detroit for a while. And I would say in Lansing, Michigan, where the white community felt competition from the black community for jobs,
mm-hmm.
particularly as the industrial base started to collapse in the
mm-hmm.
70s, I would say that racism strengthened, actually, got
mm-hmm,
worse.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that those problems are probably worse now than they were when I was a kid, frankly.
You know, isn't that interesting? We hear that as we are interviewing the people who are participating as presenters and commentators, as well as observers for our conference.
Yeah.
And we hear that jobs generally, or lack of jobs, the economy normally brings out the worst in people.
Right. I think it's the opposite here in Portland, Oregon, you know, where I'm broadcasting from, where I live now. Here, I think that there's, you know, the racial situation, and I know that there are people who would disagree with this, but I think it's much better than in Michigan anyway.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, the point I was going to make about the jobs issue and the competitiveness between races is it always struck me as interesting how the dominant white society always got upset with the minority black society when jobs were in a shortage, rather than getting mad at the people who are failing to have policies that enable all of us to work.
Yes. Yeah. The ultimate anti-poverty program is a job.
So the question I guess I'm asking, Tom, is why do you think the larger society takes it out on the minority society, because the power elite has decided there are a limited amount of jobs? You know, it's like the plantation thinking of when Miss Anne on slavery days,
mm-hmm.
when Miss Anne, who wore a size 8 dress, decided to give her secondhand clothes to the slave women. And mm-hmm. most of the slave women didn't wear size 8 dresses. Maybe one little puny slave could wear the dress.
Right.
And rather than getting mad at Miss Anne for not having enough dresses, they would rip the dress off the little girl who could wear it. And that seems to be the mentality when we talk about our economy. And I think we've seen that in Nazi Europe during World War II,
mm-hmm.
that when the economy got bad, they start scapegoating the Jewish people.
Yeah, absolutely, Janet. And in fact, I'd like to answer that and get both your and Bill's thoughts on a couple other issues that relate to this. If you can stick around, we've got to take a break.
Sure.
Okay,
good.
Great. We'll just we got a four-minute break here, and then we'll be back. We're talking with Bill Cohen and his wife Janet Langhart Cohen, the authors of Love in Black and White, a memoir of race, religion, and romance. There's going to be a conference that they're participating with on race relations in America at the D.C. Press Club on the 24th and 25th of this month. It's the Tom Hartman Program here on Air America Radio, 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Melting and the Arctic's turning green. Polar bears with seamed lairs go floating downstream. Harp seals have changed color, they're no longer white. They're now bronze, conflicted, and extremely uptight. Will it be now or later when it gets a clue? Global warming is coming, baby. It's gonna hit you.
21 minutes past the hour. We're talking with William S. Cohen, Bill Cohen, and Janet Langhart Cohen, authors of Love in Black and White, a memoir of race, religion, and romance. And, of course, Bill Cohen, the former senator and Republican senator and Secretary of Defense under the Bill Clinton administration. Janet, I just wanted to give you a quick thought on your question, because it's a very thoughtful and provocative one about why it is that that minority groups are essentially demonized during times of economic difficulty. In the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, there was a large wave of Irish immigration in the 1840s and 50s when the potato famines were going on. Over a million Irish came to the United States.
Right.
And then in the 1880s, there was a large wave of Italian immigrants. And in both cases, there were literally books written that you can still find about the genetic criminality of the Irish or the Italians, depending on which of these generations you're talking about.
Right.
They were discriminated against. They were treated very, very badly. Leo DiCaprio made a movie out of, about this. I think that there's just, when people are stressed, there's that instinct to blame the other. And the other is whoever's most conspicuously the other. So if it's skin color or if it's the accent or if it's language, does that ring true to you?
Yes, it does, and I am well aware of how the early immigrants from Europe were treated coming here. I think Martin Scorsese, did a film, The Gangs of New York.
Yeah, that's the one that DiCaprio was in.
Yeah, he was in that one. That was very illustrative of what the early European immigrants had to deal with. However, what you have to also understand is in Europe, race wasn't the issue as much as religion, whether you were Catholic or Jewish or Lutheran or Protestant or whatever.
Yeah.
Race became an entity, a power construct here in North America, in this country, and despite and not diminishing any of the struggles that the early European immigrants had, once you get here, as Noel Ignatieff, a scholar, has written in his book entitled How the Irish Became White, because race is the determining dividing line in this country, they are allowed to assimilate over a generation or two.
Right.
Blacks have not been able to do that. We've been able to do it socioeconomically if we are fortunate enough to overcome racism, but we've never been able to assimilate the way that the Irish and the Italian or the Polish or other European groups have been able to do. So while their early history, I remember living in Boston and the Irish telling me, the elders telling me there used to be signs up in Boston saying, no Irish, no dogs,
right.
No Irish need apply.
Yep.
But we all know the happy ending to that story, that it was 40-some years ago that we had our first Irish Catholic president. We are just now emerging with our first black nominee of a party.
Right.
And, we came over before everybody else. We were here before the Irish.
Yep.
So it's just very interesting to see the role that race plays in North America. And, one can change their name, lose their accent, and as long as they have no pigmentation, they have something called unearned white privilege.
Which raises the question, and I'd like both of you to take a shot at this, and I'm sorry we only have 2 minutes here left before the break at the bottom of the hour, but Barack Obama, how does he walk this line of race in America? How do we continue this conversation? And do you think that it's conceivable that we're near that boundary, that stepping over point that the Irish and the Polish and the Italians crossed over, that African Americans can cross over that line and become, quote, just totally American, and we just stop the prefix names.
Let me answer that quickly, if I can, for 1 minute of the two. Barack Obama, to the extent, if he is ever elected president of the United States, that will be quite a statement about how far white America certainly has traveled since the inception of slavery back here 300 or 400 years ago. But it will not necessarily change life for millions of black people in this country. They still have to cope with a system where there has been a systematic and institutionalized racism, and that is being winnowed away. The racial divide in this country is still deep. It's not as wide as it once was, and what we're hoping to do is to change that through a series of continuing this dialogue, so we can understand why it is we hold people with prejudice because of pigmentation or because of religion. But I think it will be a statement about America, should he be elected, but it will not change for the most part in a fundamental way unless we really get to the root of what we have to do in the way of education and economic opportunity. That needs to be established on a much wider basis than the President of the United States.
The sadness, Tom, and the perversity in your question, not your question, but in your question, is the fact that you have to ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of our country. Here we are, the land of the free, home of the brave, and our founders said they wanted independence, they wanted equality and justice for all, and that was their principle, but their practice was bondage and slavery.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to find out how we got here and what we do about it. And while you may not have had slaves and I wasn't a slave, as James Baldwin, the great author, says, we're all here now and we're all accountable and we have to do something about it to move into a more perfect
world. Brilliantly said. Janet Cohen, William Cohen, the book Love in Black and White. Thank you both.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
The hour. Well, so far, Louise's favorites are Chewbacca and Magnum P.I., but we'll see. People offering suggestions for the name for our new kitten that Steve and Tammy rescued and we got from them. And this a cat that loves to chew on people, among other things. They couldn't, they had to keep him away from the other cats, although, you know, Higgins said, like that. they will work it out. In any case, a strange stuff. Speaking of alerts, and then we'll pick up your phone calls on you know, anything you want to talk about today, 866-303-2270. But our conservative alert for the day, I mean, this is just incredible. Just incredible. First of all, we all know that there are high levels of asthma among people who either have poor nutrition or who live in old houses, particularly with lead paint, or who in particular live near highways and or live near industrial sites. And when you go to any major city, and where are the highways and where are the industrial sites? In the poorest parts of town. And that's where you'll find the highest rates of asthma, number one. Number two, autism is real. So as I was saying, this arc. Conservative alert for the day, Michael Weiner, known as Michael Savage on the radio.
I want to tell you my opinion on autism, a fraud, a racket. For a long while, we were hearing that every minority child had asthma. Why was there an asthma epidemic amongst minority children? Because I'll tell you why. The children got extra welfare if they were disabled, and they got extra help in school. It was a money racket.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you have asthma, you get extra welfare. What, an inhaler? Come on.
Everyone went in and was told, when the nurse looks at you, you go, I don't know, the dust got me. So everyone had asthma from the minority community. That was number one. Now the illness du jour is autism. You know what autism is?
No, Michael, tell us. What is autism?
I'll tell you what autism is in 99% of the cases. It's a brat who hasn't been told to cut the act out.
A brat who hasn't been told to cut the act out? Michael Savage, are you really saying this?
That's what autism is. What do you mean they scream and they're silent? They don't have a father around to tell them, don't act like a moron, you'll get nowhere in life. Stop acting like a putz. Straighten up, act like a man. Don't sit there crying and screaming, idiot.
Aren't we all just so blessed to have so many right-wingers on so many right-wing stations, on so many very large and powerful right-wing stations, sharing the compassionate conservative message with all of America? It's extraordinary. 866-303-2270, our number. Leon in Seattle. Hey, Leon, what's up? Leon, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was just wanted to comment on what was being said. I think that we have to get beyond this guilt and just realize that African Americans have contributed huge amounts to this country and have gotten very little in return, comparatively. Yeah. I mean, they were promised 40 acres and a mule after the Civil War, and it just, you know.
Yeah, it didn't happen. And they, by and large, built this country.
Yes, and, you know, one of the things that really struck me, they just opened the Northwest African Museum, African American Museum here in Seattle this past spring. And in looking through genealogies there, I thought, you know, these people finding out they're descended from slaves, you know, and you know, my people, we came, you know, people with European descent came with the ability to read and write, you know, a skill, jobs, everything. These people came as slaves.
Yeah.
And they haven't had much support from the government ever since.
Yep. Yeah, and to this day, as a result of racism, endemic racism, racism built into our system, into our structures. I remember in 83 or 84 when Louise and I moved to Atlanta. We lived in Atlanta for 13 years. And Louise flew down to look at houses, and the real estate agent said, would you like to look at homes in white communities or black communities or mixed communities? And Louise said, I can't believe you're asking me that question. I want to talk to a different real estate agent. I will not tolerate somebody asking me a question like that. But that was the way it was. That was the view. Steve in Los Angeles. Hey, Steve.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Relative to your guests, Bill and Janet Cohen, I had a couple comments, and I think one of the biggest problems with the not getting over the race issue is, as a society, I think we mistakenly misuse ethnicity and race interchangeably. For example, if you get an application, you're applying for a loan, and they say, what's your race? It really should be, what's your most recent ethnicity? Because the genetic scientists know we're all one human race, so I don't get it.
Yeah, well, that's the where science collides with culture. You're absolutely right. There is no gene for race. There's no gene that makes a person black or white or Indian, Native American or Asian American or Asian or whatever. There are genes, probably millions of them collectively of characteristics, genes that control the size and features of a person's mouth, of their eyes, of their ears, the color of their skin, the color of their hair, and they're all independent of each other. And the various races seem to be, by and large, probably over time genetic adaptations to climate. But beyond that, I mean, you know, people with a lot of pigment in their skin can deal with a lot of sun, and people with very little pigment in their skin can live in very northern climates and still get vitamin D because their skin is so much more sensitive. But beyond that, I mean, you know, isn't it time for us to say, okay, we're going to move beyond this? Al in California. Hey, Al.
Hey, hi. I just want to correct a couple of errors of the facts that Janet Cohen said, that the blacks were here before the Irish, which is not true. The Irish were here first. They were brought over as indentured slaves. They worked the docks. When the blacks were brought here as slaves, they actually were taught English by the Irish.
Yeah, there were a lot of indentured workers who, in fact, in New Hampshire or in Vermont, where we used to live, we had a local guy put in some flagstone for a terrace for us, or for a kind of our driveway, and he said it came from a quarry that they just reopened. It hadn't been mined or anything for over 150 years, and it was a quarry that was mined by Irish and Welsh indentured servants. But the difference was that those indentured folks who came over in the 1600s and the 1700s, by and large, and some of them in the 1800s, actually quite a few of them. Their indenture was typically for 2 years, 5 years, 8 years, in exchange
Replaced. They were replaced by blacks, just as the Latinos are replacing workers now. They were the poor Irish were working at the lowest paid jobs until the slaves were brought here.
Yeah.
The slaves came with
in the North.
They didn't come in the North. They came in the South.
No, but I'm saying that as the South, when the South became an agricultural force, it became an agricultural force not as a result of Irish labor, but as a result of African labor.
Oh yeah, that was later. Later.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
So okay.
Get that point across.
Thanks a lot, Al, for the call. I appreciate it. Roger in Cape, is it? How do you pronounce it, Roger? Cape.
Yeah, Cape.
Okay.
Cape. Hey, I think part of the problem, you know, this issue of assimilation versus mixing people, you know, the difference between a melting pot versus a laminated society. You know, when we have like real strong cultures interact with us, a person who takes years to create something original, a motif or art or music, for example, or science or math, and shows them to these people from strong cultures, you know, they do not tend to clone it or copy it. Whereas people who are assimilationists, if you show them something original, you can lose it in 5 minutes. And then the other thing is that assimilationists also want to proselytize a little bit. It's kind of a little of you, a little of me. And so they tend to undermine the reference consistency of rational systems for other cultures. So people tend to avoid them. So
you'll see a lot
of assimilationists mixing, and then you'll see a lot of separatist mixing in laminated societies.
Yeah, let me translate this, if I may, and
okay.
Tell me if I've got the essence of your comment right.
Okay.
I was in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. There's a chapter or two in there about Native Americans and Native cultures, and I suggest that the Great Melting Pot, this wonderful mythos of America that we're this Great Melting Pot, is really the velvet glove over the iron fist of a single dominator culture that says all other cultures are inferior. And we'll let you be part of our culture. Just be like us and leave your culture behind. And so Africans came here. They lost their languages. They lost their religions. They lost their traditions. Native Americans, there was a virtual cultural genocide
genocide. Comanche organizer, and I work a lot with Indians.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of elders who they will not talk with whites again because some whites made dictionaries of parts of their language, and they considered that a suspect. So, see, what you see is this greater culture that's assimilating everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see massive separate societies maintaining their art, culture, a lot of the rational systems, even though the language, the trade language has changed, but the way of thought stays the same. And then I see this other mass, you know, of people floating around, irrational, fragmented, not fused, but fragmented because it's parts of so many different systems. There's no reference literature.
Yeah.
You know, a Puritan, a lot of people say, for example, might look at the Puritans as being a little askew, a little bit, you know, out of date, archaic. But here's one thing about them. Their children at least can refer to a litany of literature remarks that are consistent with their Bibles. For people who have picked up parts of Buddhism, Catholicism, Judaism, they can be very confused.
Yeah, the digital or the Delhi religions. Roger, interesting. But this raises a whole lot of issues of, you know, how diverse is good diverse, and to what extent do you try to homogenize or heterogenize culture? 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Price for truth, and money doesn't bleed red, white, and blue. Oh, no, 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 and it never won't. Oh, say, can you see everybody's buying, but nobody's free? I won't be bought, freedom's all I own, and I know it's out there. And now I'm gonna find it before
9.5 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
What's the big news out of Washington, D.C. and the rest of the world today?
Well, it's a remarkably quiet day, I can tell you that. So there's not a lot of news. But the only story going on in the White House briefing room, really, apart from a trickle of news about Iran that nobody got very excited about, is timelines, timetables, and aspirational time horizons.
All these ways of saying, yeah, okay, we'll go along with the Obama plan, but we're not going to call it anything that sounds like the Obama plan?
Yes.
Or the Maliki plan?
Yes, even though Dana Perino was specifically asked about the Obama plan and whether they were basically going along with that, she refused to get into that. And she was specifically asked about the Maliki plan and whether they were going along with that. She says that they are in agreement, that this is all about the conditions on the ground, that this is not about any set date. She seemed to be oblivious. She seemed to be tone deaf to what was being said by the members of the press corps when they asked their questions, when the questions referenced things like 16 months or 2010.
Mm-hmm.
She seemed unable to hear those questions.
Seriously? She didn't say, no, I won't take that, or she didn't, tiptoe around it. She just...
Well, she tiptoed around it. She definitely tiptoed around it, but she never really addressed it. She would never say, she certainly never said, I'm not going to speak to that, because that would have been a direct answer. She
right.
gave indirect answers to all of these issues, really. The main thing that she seemed to be saying was that the two sides, Iraq and the United States, are on the same page. She talked about the agreement that they're working on, that they want to get finished by July the 31st, and this being July the 21st, she didn't want to convey a sense of urgency, but did want to convey that, you know, we're getting to the point where we want to get this deal done.
Yeah, well, it's got to be done before the end of the year, or we've got to entirely pull out of Iraq, or we'll be in violation of UN conventions.
Exactly, but they want to get it done by July the 31st, and that's their goal. And they believe that they can get it done. Now, I asked the question, and of course I got slapped down for asking it. I asked the question whether, seeing as they were talking about aspirational time horizons, and the Iraqis are talking about 2010 and 16 months, the two didn't seem to be on the same page, was there a possibility that the Iraqis are actually negotiating in public?
Right.
And
what was the response?
Anything's possible.
Well, yeah, I think that they are, frankly. I think that that's the only leverage that Maliki has right now is public opinion and the possibility of an Obama presidency. And in my opinion, tell me if you think I'm wrong on this, it seems to me that the Iraqi people are there very much too, both the Shia and the Sunni and the Kurds, that they basically want us to get the hell out and they want to take control of their own oil revenues and they want to rebuild their own country in their own way. And, you know, the ethnic cleansing has now happened. There's, 2.5 million internal refugees, 2 million external refugees, apparently 1 million dead. I mean, this is the latest study to come out of the British government. As many as 1 million people in Iraq have died
really?
As a consequence of this war. Yeah, yeah. So the ethnic cleansing has happened. The Bush genocide is done. And sort of like in Rwanda, you know, after the ethnic cleansing and the genocide, it wasn't that hard to put it back together. And, you know, it was a god-awful thing, and I certainly would never commend that as, you know, a way to do something, but that's how the Bushies have done it. And Maliki now has, you know, they've got neighborhoods with, you know, blast fences and barbed wire, and, you know, it's like Northern Ireland, I suppose, in some ways, only far worse, back in the day. And they figure, hey, okay, we can put this thing back together now. Just, you know, give us the money and get your corporations out of here, by the way. Why is Halliburton taking $1 billion when the average salary for the average Iraqi right now is $500 a year? Why are you paying $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year to American contractors to come in and build substandard buildings when we can build very good buildings, thank you very much, with labor at $500 a year?
And, of course, contractor immunity was a huge deal in the negotiation.
Right, right, yeah, and I think it's going to be an even bigger deal because that's really where the money is, and they get it. That's how we're sucking the money out of their country, that's how we're sucking the money out of our country via their country back to the cronies of the. I mean, we have crony capitalism here. Hey, listen, Victoria, Condi Rice issued a cable to U.S. missions that forbade them. I guess is the correct tense. From holding any kind of events for presidential candidates, and this was spoken in the general, right? But or arranging any kind of meetings for them, haven't state departments traditionally done this? I mean, you know, when McCain went over, there was no such cable from Condi Rice, and I would be astounded if the U.S. mission in Iraq, the so-called embassy in Iraq, and the U.S. Charge d'affaires or whoever it is. I guess we're dealing with the Swiss and Iran and whatever we have in Afghanistan and Jordan. I think we have a full embassy in Jordan. If they were not involved in John McCain's travels in the Middle East, Israel certainly, why would Condi Rice say that they can't be involved in Barack Obama's travels?
That's very interesting. I'm certainly don't remember there being any kind of cable going out at the time of John McCain's most recent trip.
No, I can confirm that it did not. This is a first. This is the first time that the State Department has ever issued any kind of a paper like this, any sort of a directive to their members all around the world saying, the only way that this can work is, or you guys can't participate with presidential candidates, a.k.a. Barack Obama.
I guess all that pride she felt about Barack Obama's achievements for African Americans only went so far.
She said that, Condi Rice?
Yes, she said that in an interview, yes.
Oh, well, a nice comment, I suppose, but, geez. Yeah, you're right. It only went so far. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, are the disaster capitalists, the monopolists, the monopoly capitalists, the crony capitalists, the laissez-faire capitalists, as opposed to the Roosevelt / Eisenhower regulated capitalists, who actually gave us an economy that worked, are the disaster capitalists preparing to finally shut the whole thing down and take over the world? Not a rhetorical question, actually. Today in the Financial Times, a couple of stories I want to share with you from the Financial Times about this topic. It's just, and it all plays into, starting with Ronald Reagan, the destruction of labor in the United States and the rise of finance, the rise of disaster capitalism, as Naomi Klein writes about in her book Shock Doctrine. The Shock Doctrine, is her book Disaster Capitalism or Shock Doctrine? I forget which. One's in the title, the other's the subtitle. But in any case, the Shock Doctrine at work. Here's the lead editorial in today's Financial Times. The lead editorial, the headline is Bad Debts Mean More Bank Bids. The subhead, the next step toward a recovery is a wave of takeovers. In other words, let's just do away with all these pesky small companies, these mom-and-pop shops, these small banks that are owned regionally and locally and actually have owners who are responsible to their communities. Let's just do away with them all, and let's just end up with four or five or six big banks in the United States that run the whole show. You know, the way we've done it with the oil business, the way we've done it with the recording industry business, which by the way, is 97% foreign-owned, the way that we've done it with the newspaper business, the way that we've done, and on it goes. Here in this editorial in the Financial Times, under the headline and subhead I just shared with you, the article says bad debts, they're talking about banks. Bad debts would surely increase, but for banking share prices, the bottom may be near. Now is the moment of maximum uncertainty about what their final loss will be. This, they say, is a good thing. This is the time for the big banks to come in and buy out the small banks and thus restore liquidity and stability to the system and have it all be one big happy fascist family. No, my words, not theirs. Actually, this is what the Financial Times says. By 2010, the lack of competition should mean that any bank with a strong balance sheet can make gravy. The next stage of the recovery process will inevitably be takeovers. And then they wrap the editorial, this is the lead editorial in today's Financial Times, they wrap it up by saying, come clean, consolidate, and raise capital. The job for the banks continues. Right. Well, we've seen that with our food supply. You've got a handful of companies, fewer than a dozen companies, largely three or four that control most of our grain, another half a dozen that control most of our other food, our processed foods. Another headline in today's Financial Times, U.S. food groups set for hefty price increases, but will wages go up? No, I don't think so. That would be called inflation. They get hysterical when wages go up. Prices of food, well, no problem. This is by Elizabeth Rigby in London and Hal Weitzman in Chicago. At least the Financial Times, I mean, it's the rich talking to the rich. At least they're upfront about it. Sarah Lee, maker of meat products such as Jimmy Dean sausages, said costs would compel it to push up prices on meat lines by up to a fifth later this year. That's 20% inflation. I'm talking about how crop prices have soared in recent months on the back of strong demand from emerging economies and supply concerns following floods across the agricultural lands of the U.S. Midwest. This may cause, they say, the biggest decline in meat consumption for 27 years. Well, I guess that's probably a good and healthy thing. Kraft Foods, they say, which has said it will push up its prices by 12 to 13% this year, said some of its cheese categories could rise by more than 25%. ConAgra Foods, another big U.S. packaged food companies, told analysts last month it would be raising prices again this fiscal year after a 5% increase across the board in March. So already up 5%, they're going to raise it even more. Again, what we're seeing here is disaster capitalism. Create a crisis and then, you know, run in and say, oh, look at this crisis that we've created. Let's do something with it, about it, to it, for it, whatever. You know, let's make some bucks on this crisis. Here's another one. Union presses city to break up. Now, this is the opposite. This is where the labor unions are saying to Citicorp, maybe it would be a better thing for us all if the bank broke up. Citicorp has come under pressure from activist union shareholders who want the financial conglomerate to break itself up. This is AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, one of the biggest unions, U.S. unions, 1.4 million members. They own stock in the bank. They're going to the annual meeting. They're saying, why don't you guys break up into smaller banks, Citicorp? Ain't going to happen. Monopoly capitalism is the thing of the day. And, in fact, it's spreading. Private equity firms, this is the very wealthy. And this, in a lot of these came about, by the way, in response to Sarbanes-Oxley. They required public companies to disclose their finances. So they just said, ah, screw it, we'll go private. So we don't have to tell you what we're up to. And we don't have to tell you what we're doing. Robert Greenwald over at BraveNewFilms.com, a great little video he did on Kravitz and I think KBR, KKR. Anyhow, Sundeep Tucker writing in today's Financial Times, private equity firms ramped up the level of minority investments in Chinese and Indian companies in the first half of the year amid a fall in buyout opportunities in Asia and beyond, according to a study. The total value of investments by private equity firms in deals involving a stake purchase but not a change in control climbed almost 20% in both China and India, according to the Center for Asia Private Equity Research. So here we are. I mean, here we are in the midst of disaster capitalism. Edmund Phelps, this is an op-ed in today's Financial Times. He says, many people see every downturn of employment from a long sustained plateau as a fall of aggregate demand. You know, in Keynesian economics, if people don't have money, then they can't spend it. If they can't spend it, demand falls. So he says if employment is down because of aggregate demand, the problem can be addressed at zero cost through rate cuts and the ensuing rise in the money supply. Many central banks like to do that. It's called lean against the wind. What we're talking about here is what Greenspan started doing in the 80s, saying, oh, you're not making any money anymore? The Republicans have successfully destroyed your union. We shipped your job to China. You're working as a greeter at Walmart now for a fifth of what you used to make. Don't worry. You can still buy a new TV. You can still make your house payments. You can still buy that new car. We will loan you the money cheap. Don't worry. You know, 12 months, no interest, et cetera, et cetera. And this is the overextension of credit. The New York Times did a great piece on this weekend. And it's absolutely incredible. In the 1920s, this is when, this was back when 2- and 3- and 5-year mortgages were the norm. And you had to refinance them every couple of years. And so there wasn't that much mortgage debt. In today's dollars, translated into today's dollars, the average family debt in the United States was $9,889. Okay, in the 1930s, the average debt in the U.S. was around 10,000. The average savings, though, was around $1,000. Today, the average debt in the United States is $117,951, and the average savings is $392. Now, compare that with the year that Reagan took power in 1981. The average debt was under $40,000, $39,800, and the average savings was $7,000. So we were the average wage earner, the average family in the United States had saved that year in 1981 that Reagan came into office $7,000. The average person in 1 year saved $7,000 and had a total debt of $39,000. The credit card debt of that was virtually nothing, a few hundred dollars. Because we had these laws that said that the credit card companies, couldn't offer a credit card to your dog. There were limits on what could be offered and limits on, then they got deregulated toward the late 80s, and we saw an explosion in credit card debt. We saw an explosion in installment debt, home equity loans, which for all practical purposes didn't even exist when Reagan came into office, have exploded, and mortgages have exploded. There's this marvelous interactive graphic over, it's on the New York Times website, newyorktimes.com, that chronicles all of the events that brought this about. And in every single case, what it was deregulate the marketplace, allow for disaster capitalism, and then the disaster capitalists, the opportunists, the big fish, they come in and they eat the small fish and the medium-sized fish, and while they're at it, while they're wiping out all the mom-and-pop businesses and all the small regional businesses, they're also sucking all the money out of our homes.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, the most labor-friendly program in all of radio. Our program brought to you in part today by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more at Teamsters.org. Excuse me, Teamster. It's singular. Teamster.org. Tim Newman is on the line with us right now. He's a spokesperson for the International Labor Rights Forum. Their website, laborrights.org. And there's a new campaign. Tim, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you with us. There's a campaign to stop Firestone from their Bridgestone and Firestone company from their exploitation, I guess would be the word, of the people of Liberia.
Yes. So this is a campaign focused on Firestone's. They own the world's largest rubber plantation in Liberia, and they've been operating there since 1926.
Right.
So the basic situation is that there are what they call rubber tappers who have to tap raw latex from trees.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have an unreasonably high daily production quota that they have to meet, or their salaries, which are a little bit over $3 a day, will be halved. So in order to meet that quota, they have to bring their wives and their children to work with them just to make that one person's meager salary. And the work is extremely physically demanding. They have to carry two buckets weighing 75 pounds each on a stick on their backs and walk for miles without any protective gear. And they also live in crowded one-room shacks without running water, electricity, or indoor latrines. And Firestone also dumps toxic chemicals into local rivers. And that's just the start of some of the abuses there.
Amazing. Now, this, I'm assuming this isn't rubber that is used for tires anymore. This is for things like latex gloves, is that?
No, it's definitely used in tires that we consume right here in the U.S.
Oh, really? We still we still have rubber in our tires?
Definitely.
I thought mostly they were made out of oil these days. They figured out some way to make petroleum into tires.
That's part of it, but yeah, they definitely still use latex from Liberia.
Huh, interesting. And so this campaign, StopFirestone.org, and your organization, the International Labor Rights Forum, LaborRights.org, what specifically beyond highlighting this issue are you calling for?
Well, we have an international campaign. The Stop Firestone campaign is actually a coalition of U.S. and Liberian-based organizations. So groups in
now do Liberian organizations do this at some political risk? I mean, what's the political climate like there? In a lot of these countries, if look at Colombia, they've had so many, or down in even in Mexico, the number of people who've been trying to organize Coca-Cola, for example, who've been murdered is shocking. Number in Colombia, it's even worse. I mean.
In terms of Liberia, as many people probably know, the country is now has a democratic president, the first woman president democratically elected in Africa. But they're still, reemerging from civil war, a long civil war. So we found that the organizations do have the democratic space now to do their work and to support workers and environmental protection. And the Minister of Labor is extremely supportive of labor there. He's quite unusual when we look at other countries in comparison, including our own.
Right.
Oddly
enough, including our own. I mean, you say, oh, yeah, well, that's a problem in the third world, but we have a very, very labor-hostile government here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And it's quite quite good to see that the Labor Minister of Labor is actually extremely supportive of labor as opposed to our own country.
So what are the prospects? We're talking with Tim Newman, who's a spokesperson for the International Labor Rights Forum. What are the prospects of change happening there? I mean, first of all, to put this in economic context, if these people were paid enough money that they didn't have to bring their children and their wives to work to cut to gather rubber for their $3 a day, did you say?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
If they were paid an appropriate amount, or their acquisition thresholds, their goals, their work goals were reduced to a reasonable level. Is that going to put Firestone out of business?
Absolutely not. And it's interesting because Firestone spends millions of dollars sponsoring, the Super Bowl halftime show and all these different sporting events, and yet they still have workers working in these really atrocious conditions. However, we are at a point now where we have, in 82 years that Firestone has been in Liberia, right now is the moment where we are most poised to actually win improvements for these workers. Last year, the workers held their first democratic and independent union elections to ever take place on the plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, as we speak, the workers are negotiating their first real collective bargaining agreement. And the issue that they are really butting heads with management on is this issue of wage increases.
Right.
So I think that if we have some solidarity from the U.S. and we put a little more pressure on Firestone, then we'll be able to help the workers get their demands met.
Are there any major U.S. unions that are joining you in this effort?
Yes, steelworkers have been very involved in supporting the Firestone workers from the beginning. They were election monitors, and also the Solidarity Center at the AFL-CIO has been extremely supportive.
Yeah, this is, and it's interesting to keep in mind, Liberia is a country that was brought into existence by President James Madison. It was mostly former American slaves repatriated there. Or maybe it was James Monroe, because Monroeville is their capital, right?
Monrovia, that's right.
Yeah, Monrovia, excuse me. And they speak English. I mean, there's a real connection between the United States and Liberia.
Absolutely.
LaborRights.org, StopFirestone.org. Tim Newman, the spokesman. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The hour, our telephone number 866-303-2270. 866-303-2270. Our website, TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com. And thanks for all the great cat names that people are suggesting for this crazed kitten that has come into our home. And yes, in response to the message board, and all of our cats are indoor cats. Louise built a little cage outside so they can get out, but that's about it. Strange stuff going on in the world. First, this from the wire services, as we like to say, in a daring bid to wrench attention from his Democratic rival in the 2008 presidential race, Senator John McCain today embarked on an historic first-ever visit to the Internet. Given that the Arizona Republican had never logged onto the Internet before, advisors acknowledged that his first visit to the World Wide Web was fraught with risk. With his Democratic rival Barack Obama making headlines with his tour of the Middle East and Europe, the McCain campaign felt that they needed to come up with something equally bold for John to do, according to one advisor. McCain aides said the senator's journey to the Internet will span 5 days and will take him to such far-flung sites as Amazon.com, eBay, and Facebook. With the press retinue watching, Senator McCain logged onto the Internet at 9 a.m. Sunday, paying his first ever visit to MapQuest.com. "I can't get this, beep, expletive deleted, thing to work," McCain said, as he struggled with his computer's mouse, causing his wife Cindy to prompt him to add that he was just kidding. having pronounced his visit to MapQuest a success, Senator McCain continued his tour by visiting weather.com and Yahoo Answers, where he inquired as to the difference between Sunnis and Shiites. Senator McCain said that he had embarked on his visit to the Internet to allay any fears that he is too out of touch to be president, adding he plans to take additional steps to demonstrate that he's comfortable with today's technology. Said the senator, "In the days and weeks ahead, you will see me rocking out with my new Walkman." Yeah. Actually, not from the wire services. No, this is from Andy Borowitz with permission. Thanks, Andy. BorowitzReport.com. That and other strange things going on in the world. Very strange things. Yeah, ready to get your feet pampered? Well, there's a spa in Alexandria, Virginia, where you put your feet in a tub full of little fish that have, as teeth, little razors that scrape off the dead skin. Yeah. They've kind of fallen out of favor with state regulators because of concern over whether they're sanitary, but that's what they're doing. John Ho runs the Yvonne Heron Nails Salon with his wife Yvonne Lee. Said so far 5,000 people have stuck their feet in the water with the fish and gotten all cleaned up. That and residents of Pinellas Park, Florida said they were shocked to, speaking of fish, shocked to see a group of about 30 fish walking on land through town. The walking catfish, a species that can't actually walk using the pectoral muscles and survive on land so long as they remain moist, perplexed residents when they began strutting through the neighborhood, according to WKMG-TV in Orlando. Homeowner Diana Fernandez says, "I was like, there's no way, fish in the street? And I kept going further and further and seeing fish everywhere in driveways. I've never seen anything like it." Neighbors said they were equally boggled by the sight. "We thought it was a prank at first," said resident Hannah Klein. "We thought that maybe somebody dumped some fish, but then we realized they were coming up from the sewer. We had so much rain last night." Oh, man, that's welcome to the Twilight Zone. I mean, it's my friend Jerry Schneiderman actually is in Brazil right now. He lives part of the year down there and part of the year up here. His wife is Brazilian, and actually she has an American passport as well. But in any case, he said that they are in this little fishing village that they live on the Atlantic coast, that they're caring for a penguin, that the town is caring for a penguin. And this is a part of Brazil. This is like they're 30 miles from Ipanema. You know, this is south of Sao Paulo, I guess, is the capital. And but it's nowhere near the Antarctic. But apparently what's happened is that the overfishing, these huge fishing trawlers with these, you know, 5 mile long drift lines that are sent out by, used to be the Japanese were really big on this. Now there's virtually every country in the world has, you know, fishing fleets down around the Antarctic. The overfishing has gotten so bad that the penguins don't have anything to eat. And so they're traveling farther than they normally would, and they're dying at sea because they can't get back to land. They're dying of exhaustion. They can't find food. And one of them washed up on the beach in Brazil, in central Brazil. And Jerry and his community are taking care of it. Isn't that sweet? Steve in Eagle Creek. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
I was just thinking, Tom, a lot of your comments that you made about disaster capitalism, what happens when it meets peak oil? Because that's like an immovable rock in a hard place.
Well, it's not. You know, T. Boone Pickens is the classic example. He's saying, hey, I've figured out a way to make money out of this disaster.
Well, if he's looking at to make money out of it, you're looking at peak oil means the end of growth. Once that's figured out.
No, it means the end of oil. It doesn't mean the end of growth.
Oil, but it'll turn society basically upside down.
It will, but it'll turn its society upside down the same way that in the mid 1800s, the primary source of lighting for Americans and Europeans was whale oil, and the primary source of heating was wood. And, you know, when I lived in Vermont, I remember seeing photos of Vermont in 1860, 1870, and the entire state, literally the entire state, there's like one little patch of maybe 100 acres of virgin forest left. The entire state was nude. It was naked. You couldn't see a tree anywhere because they'd cut them all down for firewood. And it became a population limiting factor, in fact, in the late 1860s, 1870s. In the 1880s, they ran a railroad up there and they started bringing coal up, and all of a sudden, and you could tell when the houses were built. The houses that were built after the 1880s were suddenly very large houses. The ones before the 1880s were much smaller houses because coal came along. It was cheap to heat your house with coal. And it's just a transition. It's another transition. We're moving from oil to electric to sunlight and wind.
Well, I hope that we're not going to see a situation here in Oregon where they cut the forest down to cut for the firewood for the.
No, it's actually front page of today's Oregonian. They're talking about how the electric grid that we've got right now can only handle about 2,000 megawatts, 2 gigawatts of power. And right now traveling over it is around 1.2 gigawatts, 1,200 megawatts of power. And they're planning just over the next 5 years. Planning wind farms in the Columbia River Basin that will generate 4 to 5 gigawatts, you know, 1,000 megawatts of power, which is twice what the grid can handle. And so, you know, down in Texas, they're at public expense, they're expanding the grid so that T. Boone Pickens can sell his electricity to everybody in Houston and Dallas, and he can make a whole pile of money. And
I'm still really annoyed. I'm still extremely annoyed about the actions that they took when they shut down the public owning of the utilities here. I really was mad about that. I think there ought to be an attempt again to reset and to provide public utilities for here in Oregon, because the PGE PGE is Enron.
Yeah, well, it used to be a piece of Enron. Yeah, and no, I agree with you, Steve. And we had here in the city of Portland, we had 2 out of 5 votes to go with public power. And frankly, in my opinion, the mayor dropped the ball because he was one of those 5 votes, and he could have changed everything, Mayor Tom Potter. And I, you know, my personal opinion, I think Tom Potter's a good guy, but I think he wimped out on that one. Two Hip in Northern California. Hey, Two Hip.
Hi, Tom. I'm not going to rant about any of this, you know, mad nitrates and hate-filled, you know, savage weenies, or, you know, the fat gas bag drug-laden Limbaugh, or even Hannity's insanity. But it's about.
I think you already have.
It's your sweet little cat. I have one little muddy one-eyed Waters, and I, you know, she doesn't claw like yours. But I had a couple of suggestions from the family. One is Silver Streak.
Silver Streak, okay.
Gray Panther, and my favorite is Claws for the Cause.
Applause for the cause. That's great.
And, you know, you could interpret that your own way because, again, it could be, you know, clause for hope or,
right.
you know, a Santa Claus, the clause that keep on giving.
There you go.
Well, so anyway, that was our suggestion with the family.
Okay.
And we really want to thank you for all the good work that you, Luis, and all the crew does.
Thank you. All the rest of the crew is Sean here in Portland.
Well, now, Sean included.
Sean
We've
Taylor.
Been following you since your nation days back, you know, 5 years ago, and with when Hightower was on and whatnot. And we really appreciate the progressive voices. And, of course, we seek them out. So you're doing good work.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And also Chris and Lauren in New York, who are just, you know, integral to this show and making it all work. All the folks, the great folks at Air America New York. Marvin in Miami. Hey, Marvin, we got a minute before we got to hit a break here. What's up?
Yeah, I just am aggravated because I watched National Geographic for 1 hour about the supply of poppy plants is now 90% coming out of Afghanistan, and it's creating a terrible heroin situation all over the world. And
That's
I'm wondering
right.
why we don't go in and just wipe out the fields, period. And for not us, all the NATO nations.
Yeah, no, I understand. And in fact, the I don't know if it was NATO or if it was just a group of European countries, but heroin is now down to like $3, $4, $5 a dose in most of the northern European countries because they're so close to Afghanistan and the opium is coming up, the heroin's coming up, and it's really cheap. Here's the problem, Marvin. If you go in and you just burn the fields, you got a whole bunch of farmers who got no income. And what happens? They join the Taliban. They become insurgents. They kill your people. We need to go in and work with them and help them make transitions to more appropriate crops. We're spending so much. I mean, Nick Kristof did a brilliant piece on this last week. This book, Three Cups of Tea, where the cost of one missile that we routinely drop on Afghanistan and Pakistan, $500,000, one cruise missile, would build 50 schools. That's the kind of thing that we need to be doing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man. Totally weird here. Yeah, the guy who said, and I quote, Hillary Clinton is like the stereotypical, excuse the expression, but this is the way to say it, she's the stereotypical bitch, you know what I mean? The guy who said that, the guy who said, I don't have a lot of African-American friends, and I think part of it is because I would be in an open conversation, and I would say something somebody would take wrong, and then it would be a nightmare. The guy who said poor people, in fact, are lazy. The guy who said, I wonder if I'm alone in this. You know, it took me about a year to start hating the 9/11 victims' families. It took me about a year. The guy who said about detainees, if I were president, our policy is we're going to shoot them all in the head. And if we think that they're against us, we're going to shoot them and kill them, period. Or the guy who said to Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota, the first Muslim to serve in the House of Representatives, was sworn in on Thomas Jefferson's Koran. He says, what I feel like saying, sir, is prove to me that you're not working with our enemies. Yes, that bigot, Glenn Beck, is going to fill in tonight for Larry King. I'm astounded. I'm just astounded. Let's Kung Pao Cat should be, I can't quite read it, should be Kung Pao. Oh, P-O-W Cat, Louise. The hits keep coming, and the people suggesting names over on our blog on TomHartman.com on the front page there, names for the cat. Anyhow, 866-303-2270, your telephone number, Mike in Louisiana. Hey, Mike, what's on? What's up?
My suggestion for the cat is Striker.
Striker. Yeah, he does.
You know, just as a reminder to you, you know.
Yeah, really.
And, you know, the Democrats and Republicans, if they're not going to impeach Bush, they should rename the White House the Department of Un-American Activities. I mean, that's how far it's gone, way off the scales. And, you know, on the horizon, people have been talking about horizons. The only thing it seems set up for right now on the horizons is more mad dog mentality of our politics as a whole, because, Barack is now reporting to a presidential perspective. He reports to the generals. It's almost like, you know, the Americans in a majority as the leadership of this country.
I disagree with that characterization, Mike. What I've seen of this trip, and I'll grant you, I haven't seen all of the press coverage by any means. Over the weekend, we were in Michigan for a family event, but I have seen a fair amount of it, and we recorded all the national shows and whatnot and watched. I mean, I've got to keep up on stuff. And it seems to me that unlike McCain, who always traveled with generals and always traveled with the press, Obama's actually traveling with enlisted people. He's actually hanging out with enlisted people. He's hearing the voices of literally the troops on the ground. And that's something that the McCain and Republicans in by and large generally never did. And, I think he's doing a good job on this trip. With regard to the Democrats, though, rolling over for the Republicans, yeah, absolutely. I agree with Bernie Sanders, and thanks, Mike, for the call. I agree with Bernie Sanders that every single time the Republicans call a filibuster, it's pushing 80 now, more than in the history of the United States for one congressional session. And you know, Trent Lott said right in the very beginning they were going to stop any significant piece of legislation coming out of the Democratic Party, and then they were going to run in November against the do-nothing Congress like Harry Truman did. And that's what they're doing. That's exactly what they're doing. And Harry Reid should be standing up. If he had any guts, he should be standing up and saying, okay, you want a filibuster? We'll have a filibuster. With regard to impeachment, we'll see what happens on the 25th. That's Friday of this week, I believe. If I recall my conversation with Dennis Kucinich on this program last week correctly, on Friday of this week, the hearings will be held in the House Judiciary Committee. Or maybe it's Thursday the 24th. Sometimes they take Fridays off. But I think it's the 25th. They're going to hold hearings on his article of impeachment against George Bush. And we'll see how that shakes out. We'll see what comes out of that. Bobby in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Bobby, what's on your mind today? Bobby?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'm gonna speak quick because I know you don't have much time, but I'd like to say, speaking on behalf of, most of lower class, income, we don't even consider, higher education as an option. I mean, we don't have any money to save for it. And basically we just, it's either turn towards crime or we're just basically working hard.
And there's not much to work hard at. And I'll tell you, entrepreneurialism is alive and well in minority communities and in poor communities. And the problem is that the only, people get it. They, become a capitalist, start a business, make some money. The problem is that the only thing that they can make money doing is selling drugs, or engaging in criminal activity. And some folks get very good at it, and it's an absolute tragedy.
We need
real jobs in this country.
I'd like to say that was one option I could have took, but I didn't want to become a statistic myself, and I have such a thirst for knowledge, and I have to thank you for giving me that, because I couldn't even think of going to college. Yeah, that wasn't an option for me. So I mean, you're really feeding my thirst for knowledge, and I'd like to thank you, and also offer a name for your cat in commemoration of your new book, Screw, and just to really celebrate that, as far as fixing the problem, you should name your new cat, Screwdriver.
Screwdriver. Good one. Bobby, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Screwdriver, yeah. He's more like a chainsaw, actually. Chainsaw Hartman. Yeah, what a name for a cat. Coming up tomorrow, Sutton Motley of the Media Research Center is going to be here. They've got their panties in a wad about Barack Obama getting all this press coverage. Could it be that, he's a rock star. Get over it. Anyhow, we'll talk about Michael Waldman, former speechwriter for President Clinton, is going to join me about his book, A Return to Common Sense. Of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.